Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If you're meeting someone in St. Louis, you might go to the Arch, catch a Cardinals game, or go to the Anheuser-Busch Brewery. But step back 1,000 years, and you'd find yourself in the Native American city of Cahokia. Long before Columbus sailed, Cahokia was a metropolis larger than medieval London. Multitudes flocked to Cahokia for the spectacle, sport, and yes, even the human sacrifice. Today, the site is helping change the way we think of pre-Columbian America. This hour on Point, reconstructing the story of ancient Cahokia. Can you join the conversation? Do you know about Cahokia and the human history of the American Midwest? And yes, I think you can join the conversation. Also, comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining me now from Urbana, Illinois, is Tim Pocketat. He's a professor of anthropology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and he's explored Cahokia extensively. His new book is called Cahokia, Ancient America's Great City on the Mississippi. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Tim, it is great to have you with us. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Jackie.
First of all, please take us to Cahokia. We said that it was near St. Louis, almost beside it. And tell us about your early relationship with it.
Well, I grew up not so far from there. In fact, a lot of archaeologists grew up not so far from there. Great places like this tend to have a pull on people, and I think it makes people archaeologists. I saw it first with my father when I was pretty young. I think I seem to remember at an early age deciding that I wanted to explain it. And then it took quite a while to make it through graduate school and a few excavations later, and here I am.
And we're talking about one of these mound cities. In fact, St. Louis, I never knew about Cahokia. This is the thing that amazed me. I'm from Wisconsin and have visited Indian mounds there. There's a famous one called Azatlan, not very far from Madison, which you talk about in this book. But Cahokia seems more of a mystery somehow.
I think I know it's odd, isn't it? It does seem like a mystery, and not that many people are aware of it. It's like one of those places lost in plain sight, is how a friend of mine put it. And yet it's huge. The unfortunate side of it is that it's sort of stuck in a part of the St. Louis metropolitan area that isn't known for its tourism. I mean, you don't drive through there unless you have to. It's not a particularly scenic part of the Midwest. I think that helps explain why people don't know about it. It also doesn't have the immediately visually appealing architecture that, some places in the Southwest do, or other parts of the world.
Doesn't seem as lonely. Give us, before we go on, Tim, exactly where it is and how big it was.
Well, this is the site itself, and this is really the center of a sprawling complex that's at the center of a larger region. It was own metro region at the time. The site itself, though, is just like 5 miles east of downtown St. Louis, and you can see the arch from the top of the main pyramid, which happens to be the third largest pyramid in the New World. And although you can't see this now very easily, originally the city of Cahokia, this main complex, covered about 5 square miles, and it contained like 120 earthen pyramids, all arranged around multiple rectangular plazas.
And we're talking about roughly 1000 AD to about 1250 AD.
Yeah, roughly like 1050 AD to about 1300 or so.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you were how many pyramids did you say? 120?
Well, there's 120 in this main 5 square mile area, but there's another 70, 80 or so in the sort of sprawling suburbs and outlier towns within a 25-mile radius. So, again, you can't see that very easily today unless you know where to look. Another reason why people, I think, underappreciate this place, it was really huge and, I said sprawling, but complex in a way that it was interdigitated with the farmlands. You know, the people were all connected to it. There are probably many roads that went into it. People went there for special occasions. It was the center of the world at the time.
and had a huge influence on the rest of the tribes in this country. But let's go back to that historic time that you just mentioned, to those early years. You have a lovely chapter where you talk about what it would be like to be walking through here, to be a visitor, in the second chapter of your book. And your traveler is sort of going through the day and reaching the main plaza of Cahokia as midday approaches. Tell us what he sees and hears. Could you read to us, please?
Sure. With the sun directly overhead now, the traveler is completely enveloped by pyramids, plazas, posts, dwellings, and people. In the distance, the deep rhythmic booming sounds of great skin-covered drums are audible, overlaid by a chorus of singers. Large upright marker posts, some a yard in diameter and many yards high, project skyward from the pyramids and from the plazas, lined with special rectangular buildings constructed at cardinal angles in perfect alignment to those of downtown Cahokia, still ahead. Half an hour later, the traveler reaches Cahokia's center, the focus of civic and ceremonial life. Here, between the walls and mounds in the foreground, is a flat public square, 1,600-plus feet in length and 900-plus feet in width. A host of people gathered in and around this grand precinct. They're drumming, moving, and singing. This is sacred space, not to be traversed casually, and foot traffic is directed around the ceremony taking place. Were the traveler allowed to pass, he would see this plaza, constructed of weedless, packed fine sand, edged with the finest of buildings astride the largest of earthen pyramids, the main platform at the Grand Plaza's northern end, the awesome Monk's Mound. This black-packed earth pyramid of pyramids, the one that 7 centuries later Henry Marie Brackenridge would call a stupendous pile of earth, rivals the largest in Mexico and Peru.
So you mentioned Mexico and Peru. If one has ever been to the pyramids outside Mexico City, I may be mispronouncing it, Tim. Is it
Teotihuacan?
Teotihuacan.
Right.
Your pictures look something like Teotihuacan, only made out of earth instead of stone.
Right, and which is why some people argue, and I think it's not, it's a generally more and more accepted argument that there is a Mexican design, or at least some Mexican design elements to Cahokia, if not other places in southeastern North America as well.
Who were the Cahokians?
Well, that's still a really good question. Partly I have to explain it by saying how the place came into being. There weren't always 40, 50,000 people living in this region. Around 1050, when a town started to grow very rapidly into a redesigned city, there were a lot of immigrants that came in. So that complicates the picture. They may have retained their identities for a long time, and ultimately, when it collapsed, they then kind of dispersed. So I think it's likely that there are multiple descendant communities, and chief among them, though, are the tribes in the Eastern Plains. So we're talking about the Omaha, the Osage, to the south, the Quapaw, possibly even going a little further out into Cadoan-speaking peoples, including the Pawnee. But there may also be descendants, you know, that went south that we sort of lost track of. There may be a lot of intermarriage that happened, and so you may have families kind of splintering off. So it becomes really difficult to say who they were, because they were many people.
And you have a theory about how its leaders were able to use an astronomical event to perhaps solidify their power and influence and impress others religiously. And you call this the Big Bang Theory. It's about a supernova. Can you explain that?
Actually, the Big Bang Theory goes beyond the supernova. And the supernova is maybe an important ingredient. That is, we know that this city is designed and then migration really picks up at 1050 or thereabouts. But that's based on radiocarbon dates. So we don't know the exact day or the exact year. But at 1054, there's a major astronomical event. It's the supernova that forms the Crab Nebula.
People could see it.
People could see it around the world, and it's recorded in Turkey and in China and in the southwestern United States in rock art. That date is really close to 1050, and we know, given iconography, given later historical records, that most people in the eastern woodlands their religions were based around beliefs about stars. And so this is a star, then, this supernova would appear on July 4th, 1054. And it would have appeared during the day, right, in the sky. So it would, for a couple of months. So it would have been a remarkable event that, that perhaps people could use to reformulate the way they were organized. And or, you know, politicians might have used to do that very thing and to kind of use as a legitimating reason, like, we've got to do something. But the main part of the Big Bang Theory is what then happens. In a very abrupt fashion, people pour in and rebuild this, as I said, it was a town. They rebuild it into a planned city. It looks like Mesoamerican city. They have to build a plaza. They have to level kind of a rolling topography. They have to build the initial pyramids, and they're probably working on most of those pyramids. Most of those 120 pyramids are probably being worked on right away as part of the design. There's probably avenues that are laid out, and then there are a series of other settlements that are laid out at around 1050 at the same time. So there's this sort of redesign of a whole region, which takes an extraordinary amount of labor. And then also immediately, and going all the way up into Wisconsin, where you're from, you know, there were shockwaves, and there were maybe some colonies that were set up in these distant places. And certainly then there was news spreading, and people came to see what was going on, and they would take that back. So there's immediate cultural shift that happened, and that's the Big Bang.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the ancient city of Cahokia. And with us today is Tim Pocketit. He's a professor of anthropology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and his new book about the site is called Cahokia, Ancient America's Great City on the Mississippi. And joining us now from Amherst, Massachusetts, is Charles C. Mann. He's the author of 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus, and he's a regular contributor to The Atlantic, Science, and Wired magazines. Charles Mann, it's great to have you back on Point.
Hello. Good to talk to you.
And you. And I imagine that you have been to Cahokia.
Yes.
What were your impressions?
It's pretty darn impressive. You know, there's these huge earthen mounds, and especially the central plaza is enormous. And it's pretty easy to imagine when you're there that it must have just completely knocked the socks off anybody else who would come in. I mean, back then, hundreds and hundreds of years ago, it would be rare for somebody to be in a completely man-made artificial environment that you couldn't see a forest or a field or anything like that. And there you would be in the middle of a city. It would have been an amazing transformation. You know, it was a giant show capital, and you can certainly tell that from visiting there now.
Mm-hmm.
There's also quite a good museum.
Yes. You talk about a giant show capital. I remember going to Mexico as a young preteen, a 12-year-old, and climbing up to the summit of the Temple of the Moon. And maybe that's a good age. Tim, you were about that age when you started getting interested in this place, to feel that spellbinding sense of a dizzying height looking out over this broad plain.
Yeah, in fact, I mean, monuments tend to do that. And lots of early cities, early civilizations have at the core these monumental spaces in order to impress people. Because the question always is, why would people do anything like this if they didn't have to do it? And there's not much evidence to say to show that Cahokians had to do this. So then you have to come up with a series of other explanations for why did it happen.
We just got a comment on our website from Chris S. at onpointradio.org, and he says, I just finished Pocketat's book, and it's a fascinating introduction to a society I've never heard about, even though I live in Wisconsin. We didn't select him for that reason. And seen the burial mounds he talked about at the northern end of their influence. My question is, why haven't I heard about the city? It's been well known for nearly a century. Why wasn't this taught in any high school or college history classes? Maybe you could both answer that.
Well, if I could take a stab at it first, there's certainly a bit of bias against talking about Native Americans. I have a sister who is a school teacher, and she works it into her curriculum, but I think not everybody does, and it's not even encouraged, I think, in many textbooks. We don't tend to think about what happened before 1492 as history, and yet it is. And I think that's the sticking point we have to overcome. Like, things that happened before Columbus there was a history there that mattered. Right? It even matters to us today.
Well, Charles Mann, that's actually the point of your whole book. I mean, you have sort of helped us reconfigure our imaginations about just how many people were here prior to 1492.
Yeah, when I went to school, high school in the 1970s, we didn't learn much about Native peoples, and we learned basically three things: that they walked across the Bering Straits, 12,000 years ago. They lived for the most part in these sort of small, scattered bands, and they had so little impact on the environment that when Columbus landed, the hemisphere was, for all intents and purposes, a wilderness. And I guess one way to summarize the last 30 or 40 years of work by hundreds of archaeologists and anthropologists would be to say that now the great majority of researchers think that all three of these things are wrong. People were here for far longer than previously believed. They're here in much greater numbers than previously believed, and they had far more impact on the environment than previously believed. And Cahokia is a wonderful example of that. I mean, it utterly transformed an entire region, and it just doesn't really fit in with the sort of picture that we have of small groups of people running around in a nomadic band.
Tim, we haven't had a chance to say very much about how social life was organized there. We did talk about tens of thousands of people, but it also there were complicated methods of telling time around what you call woodhenge, a lot of organized ritual human sacrifice, crop cultivation. Can you give us a little bit of a day in the life, maybe from the leadership point of view, the elite?
I think... time was certainly very important in managing time. You could say it, on the one hand, farmers knew when to plant crops, so they didn't really need to have these elite timekeepers around. But in terms of all the ritual activity that had to be coordinated in the center, keeping track of time was key. And people would, believed in the religion that was centered at Cahokia. So they would follow, the schedule that they'd be presented with, and they also, of course, need to have some kind of reassurance that there was some grander purpose behind this schedule. And so astronomy, it's all early civilizations, but at Cahokia you can see how they are scheduling things around the movement of the sun. And increasingly, I think there's also evidence for them watching the moon in the same way. So that there's both these monuments, the woodhenge you mentioned, set up to track the sun, or at least to observe the sun at certain points, even though everybody knew where it was going to be. There's also now a couple of observatory sites just outside, a few miles outside the city limits, that I think they're watching the moon, this 19-year cycle of the moon, which is fairly complicated.
So we have quite sophisticated Indian astronomers.
But these things are what keeps – I mean, that is the life of a place like this. It's all centered around belief in religion, and that is a belief in a religion that's experienced. And so the movement of things in the heaven truly, truly matters. Less so to us today, perhaps, although that could be argued, but it did to them.
We have a lot of calls, gentlemen, so let's get a few on. Alan is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome to On Point, Alan.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question. I'm a photographer who's traveled in the Midwest extensively, and at one point I was photographing a lot of Indian mounds. And I was wondering if our expert could speak to the truth that I always heard that across from Cahokia, at where St. Louis is, there was actually a larger Temple Mount complex that was completely destroyed. And secondly, if he could speak to some of the other mound complexes, like in Evansville, Indiana, there's the Angel Mounds. In southern Illinois, there are the Kincaid Mounds. And throughout the southeastern U.S., there are Mississippian structures.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, in fact, there are scores of Mississippian sites, town sites, some fairly large ones. Kincaid and Angel are two of the larger ones just along the Ohio. And both of those, not being that far from Cahokia, probably were connected historically. In fact, I would argue Angel in particular is connected historically. It develops about the same time, maybe a little later. So that this is all part of a larger history that archaeologists are now trying to pull apart. Like, what happened first? What happened next? Why did people move from one place to the next? So I, you know, your question. Let me go back to the St. Louis part of this. St. Louis used to be called Mound City. That was its name, informal name.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't have a larger mound complex than Cahokia, but it had one of the larger ones in the Eastern Woodlands. It had like 26 or 27 mounds around a plaza, including one very large mortuary mound, was sort of sitting right on the crest of the bluffs overlooking the Mississippi that you could have seen from Cahokia. So it was one of the larger ones. There was another complex, sort of a sprawling Cahokia, a piece of Cahokia at East St. Louis, and then Cahokia was the biggest part of this larger aggregation of pyramids and plazas and people.
St. Louis still is, I think, called Mound City from time to time, but you also describe in your book the effort by archaeologists and anthropologists to save this place in the early 1960s as President Eisenhower is building an interstate highway system practically right through it.
Well, in fact, right through it. They went right through one of the plazas. And at the time, archaeologists weren't thinking of this as a large city. And so they didn't fuss too much about this Interstate 5570 running right through one of the plazas because they didn't think it was. They were thinking of this as a sort of an aggregation of villages, of sort of more semi-permanent people, you know, building ceremonial mounds. And so they partly, you know, they're at fault, but certainly then they recognize this is an important place. We need to save what we can. There was a little bit of money in the federal budget to salvage what they could. And so there was a few intensive years of, you know, staying up late into the night and excavating as much as you can before the bulldozers push their way through the middle of the site and a series of other sites at the same time.
That must just make historians, writers, everybody concerned about this wince today, Charles Mann.
Yeah, it does. You know, it's sort of amazing that this huge site is a state park. It's not even a national park or anything. It doesn't have any kind of national recognition, even though it's clearly the largest Native American city north of the Rio Grande.
Hmm. Let's take another call. Mark is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I grew up like Noah Adams in Ashland, Kentucky. And Ashland, Kentucky has a central park, and in the central park are three Indian mounds that we used to run up and down when we were kids. And I was wondering if your guest knew the originators of these mounds, what kind of people they were, and that sort of thing.
Well, now that's a really tough question. I don't know those particular mounds. And you must understand there are tens of thousands of mounds, or there were, in the eastern United States. Some of my Kentucky colleagues, would know that. I don't. But I also need to point out that mound building in ancient America goes way back. It goes back now to 3500 BC in Louisiana. Those are some of the earliest monumental architecture in the New World. In fact, some people claim they are the earliest. You know, before South America, before Mexico, you have mounds being built in Louisiana. And then from there, mound building really kind of goes forward in fits and starts in, you know, large complexes, small ones, all across the eastern United States. So you have major episodes, sometimes called the Middle Woodland Period or the Hopewell Period, centered in Ohio. And then you have this another major episode called Mississippian, which is, you know, kicked off by Cahokia being built.
Speaking of – I'm sorry.
It's lots of mounds.
Well, speaking of that, I was just, again, from your book, the excavation meant to say that excavating these mounds, it's hard to know what's in them until they are excavated, of course. That is one of the most, to me, astonishing things about what was found there. I mean, could you talk about this excavation that went on, somebody wanted to build a hotel and gave them permission to dig, and one of the most important finds was made that way?
Well, it happens less today, thank goodness, because people are generally more aware, and there's also burial laws in place now, national and state laws. So this doesn't happen so much now, but in the 50s and 60s, before the laws were in place and as the St. Louis metro area was expanding, there were always somebody was, routinely ripping down a mound. The one good example that you mentioned was a professor in St. Louis at Washington University got word of a some human remains coming out of a mound near Cahokia, and he went over to investigate. Turns out it was a mortuary tomb filled with like 170 the remains of 170 people. And he was allowed 3 months to, you know, basically dig as much as he can with volunteers. He had no money, but he did it. He never had time to write it up. And it turns out it's this remarkable we've gone back and analyzed it. It's a remarkable find of possible female sacrifices and maybe infant sacrifices to commemorate the closure of what was probably a mortuary temple. And that accounts for the rest of the 170 people. The bones from this temple were stacked onto the floor, and then the whole mound was built over the top. I mean, it's actually fantastic information that was almost lost, except for this archaeologist.
Let's take another call because I think it speaks to your point. Nick is calling from Keene, New Hampshire. Hi, Nick.
Hi, Jackie. Thanks for taking my call. I'm chiming in today just because I'm hearing this conversation, and I've recently been reading works by something of a political revolutionary historian named Ray Raphael. And in it, he goes into some good detail about how sort of racially biased and racist propaganda was actually used to spur the American Revolution. And I just wonder that, like, over the course of our history, we seem to have a natural tendency to sort of mythologize things and kind of muddle facts. And I've recently been learning about, like, the actual structures of Native societies, and I'm wondering, to what effort and to what length do you think the discovery of Cahokia and other cities and towns like it may help enhance our understanding of the real nature of the society back then, as opposed to this sort of image we have of savages in cloths just roaming about the plains in teepees and going to war with each other and such.
Charles, you want to take that?
Well, sure. One of the issues is that for some reason historians tend to regard Native history as prehistory and therefore not really part of history. And, of course, historians write the textbooks in schools. And, you know, it's a phenomenon I've heard many archaeologists and anthropologists complain about, which is that they get to the first 15,000 years of history in the Western Hemisphere, and they kind of do a little bit of hand-waving and then quickly get on to the Europeans that they're comfortable with. And one of the things about the you know, bringing into prominence of places like Cahokia is that it is, I believe, forcing historians to look backwards more carefully and to recognize that this just isn't this mushy stuff called prehistory, but that there is a lot of things that we now know about these places. They have a history, and we can say something interesting about it.
You know, you write in your book, Tim, that the myth you make about a place is one of the things that survives it. And that did not survive in Cahokia, although they had wanted it to. They wanted to put their own imprimatur, if you will, on what would come after them.
Yeah, you would think that Cahokia itself is an indication of that desire to put their mark on the landscape. At least it was some people's desire at some point in time. What's odd is, and part of the reason why we, too, have a hard time remembering Cahokia and appreciating it today is that it does seem to have been forgotten. Early explorers were not told anything about the place. In fact, no European wrote anything about it until, like, 1810, and the first Breckinridge, the first guy who actually saw it and published newspaper accounts about it. And various peoples, Native peoples, were asked, and they had really no stories about this former city. So it leaves one to wonder if, you know, was it an intentional act of forgetting? Did something go wrong?
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Cahokia, the Native American city on the banks of the Mississippi. And with us in the studio is Tim Pawkatat, the author of Cahokia, Ancient America's Great City on the Mississippi, and also the author Charles Mann, who wrote 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus. Tim, we were talking just before the break. You know, there are so many fascinating details I want to get to about the day-to-day life over the couple hundred years that Cahokia was at its height. You talked about your traveler going into the city. What about these extraordinarily prescribed funeral sacrifices, the sacrifices of lots and lots of people at one time. And then I want to get into the games that were played there all the time, this game of Chunky that went on for hundreds of years.
Well, as Charles said, I mean, Cahokia and other places like it are all about theater. And so most everything that we find has some kind of public element to it. That includes that game, the Chunky game, which all the way to contact and, in fact, into the 19th century was often played in public plazas and with onlookers, lots of gambling, you know, people wagering on who would win and sometimes teams from other towns coming in and playing. It was a big deal. And, in fact, Cahokia seems to have scaled up that game. It was originally a kid's game, and then by 1050, it becomes this big official sport. And it looks like Cahokians are giving away the stones and maybe the rules of the game, you know, are traveling outward up and down the Mississippi. And those kinds of games and other feasts and big religious festivals would take place, you know, every year, probably multiple times over the course of a year. Less frequently, but still on some kind of regular basis, and that's every few years. We're not quite sure how this worked. There were sacrificial rites, and we know this because there was a dozen plus mounds, most of which have been destroyed by St. Louis and East St. Louis, which we knew there were trenches full of human remains, and there was one of these, actually two, excavated professionally, and in those we find sacrificial pits of sacrifices, human sacrifices, mostly women. And usually in any particular pit, you have between a dozen and upwards of 53 women. And that would have happened once every, like I say, seven, 10 years, something like that, given the frequency of these pits that were discovered.
Yeah, I think one of the web stories about your book was called "Sacrificial Virgins on the Mississippi."
Right, right. And I got some grief over that one. I never said they're virgins. They're certainly younger women, and probably they have a part to play in this religious drama, where they are sacrificing themselves as representatives of some kind of corn mother or earth mother goddess. That gave, you know, if it's anything like we know from the contact period or more recent narratives, the corn mother gave of herself, you know, sacrificed her body so that people could have corn. And so that might be the idea behind this highly religious act that still involved occasionally executing a fairly large number of young women.
Charles?
You know, Jackie,
yeah?
when you talk about human sacrifice, it's, of course, you know, completely fascinating, and we tend to think of it as this unbelievably exotic and sort of horrible thing they did in the past. But it's important to remember that that ritualized public execution was a worldwide phenomenon. You know, at the same time that the Cahokians are doing this kind of thing all throughout Europe, there are these, you know, public execution spectacles in which there would be, you know, in Tyburn Square in London, there would be weekly or monthly executions that were, you know, like shows that were done that attracted thousands of people. And you can read the diaries of people like Samuel Pepys, who talk about, hiring people to wait for them in line, and then they would go in and get, you know, good seats, and how there would be, you know, religious chants and people being ripped apart and so forth. So when we're talking about these kind of things, it seems to be a sort of a universal human impulse. We don't do it so much now, but it's not as strange as it might seem from, you know, the way when one immediately thinks about it.
Well, and of course, in Europe, they weren't reenacting the corn goddess sacrifice either.
No, it was a different religious thing because the execute, you know, when you committed a crime, you were thought of committing a crime against the king, who is the representative of God on earth. And there's a whole religious element to this kind of thing that was, you know, in both cases, the deaths were serving to, you know, strengthen the state in a spiritual way.
Hmm. Let's take another call. Marion is calling from New Albany, Indiana. Welcome to On Point, Marion.
Hi, Jackie.
Hi. What's your comment, Marion?
I was born in St. Louis and grew up there, and I never really knew about the mounds. Until about 60 years later, my brother told me that he had visited the visitor center and learned about it, and I went there, and it was just astonishing to learn about this huge, successful culture that lived more centuries than our own country had lived.
Did you visit the site then?
Yes, I did. And I thought the visitor center was thrilling when that gauze curtain lifts and you're looking deep into the museum and see the dioramas. That was a wonderful way of showing the human life that was there.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Marion. Let's get a few more calls in here. John is calling from Austin, Texas. Hello, John.
Hi, how you doing? You referred earlier to some Louisiana mound builders. I believe that's probably the Caddo Indians, which also extend into Texas, and I'm in Central Texas. And what I remember reading a long time ago, and I want to know if some of this information is correct, because I've told several people and I've had doubts about what my recollection is, was that some of these areas, the mound builders, the culture persisted in the same areas for as much as like 500 to 800 years, and that these mounds were typically built one on top of the other where you can peel the layers away over hundreds of years. And I remember an artist rendition, I believe it was in Texas Parks and Wildlife magazine, of a population of tens of thousands in some of the areas around Central Texas, which, if I remember right, subsisted off a base of pecan meal in their diet, the way that some other cultures subsist off cornmeal, for instance.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, John. What about that relations? How far does the Cahokian influence go, Tim? Someone else had written it on our website, Aneem. Are East Coast tribes mentioned in any oral histories or legends shown to be influenced by Cahokia?
There's something of a divide when you move eastward. When you get up the Ohio River, there's probably a whole different series of language communities. And the Mississippian culture, this thing that emanates out of Cahokia and then out of its sister complexes, doesn't seem to move across that barrier very easily. The Northeast is not clearly influenced by Cahokia. The Southeast, however, definitely was. And you can see some of the gods themselves are adopted, maybe even carried from Cahokia to a place like Etowah in Georgia, or down the Mississippi River itself into Louisiana again. There's some large mound complexes, and clearly Cahokians had been visiting, if not even living at some of those places on a part-time basis. In fact, I was just working this summer in Wisconsin near La Crosse on a problem of early colonies. There are colonies there.
Which is on the Mississippi River.
It's right on the Mississippi River, and we found Cahokian houses and Cahokian pots and whatnot this summer. And showing that they're up there engaging the local people who were also mound builders of another sort and bringing about some fairly radical change. So it depends on where you are when in time as to how much continuity there is in these mound building cultures. There's some sort of dramatic ruptures, too, in the past. And Cahokia represents, I think, one of those ruptures.
Well, we'll talk about that rupture a little bit later. Bill is calling from North Harrell, Vermont. Welcome to On Point, Bill.
Hi. Last few years, I've become very interested in early Native cultures and traveled a lot in Mexico, including Teotihuacan outside of Mexico City. About a year ago, I saw a picture of Cahokia, which I'd never heard of, like many, many people, and was fascinated by the resemblance of the layout to what I remembered from Teotihuacan. At a conference, I met a man who comes from along the St. Lawrence River in Quebec, and is part Native Canadian, Iroquois maybe, I'm not quite sure. And I told him about that, and he smiled and nodded, and he said, yes, of course. He said, the people in Teotihuacan sent out what he called it was the Northern Wave of settlers, traders, and people of that sort. And I said, I've never heard of that. And I've read a few books about this. And he looked at me and he smiled and he took his fingers and touched his mouth and moved his hand away from his mouth. And I said, what's that? He said, oral tradition. That's it.
Interesting. Okay. Thank you, Bill. Charles, what about that point that the people from Teotihuacan sent people north and that they might have been part of the founding fathers, if you will, of Cahokia?
Well, it's extremely controversial, and I don't think there's really good evidence one way or the other. You know, on the one hand, there is these obvious visual similarities. On the other hand, if you're going to be building monuments out of stone or earth, there's only a certain number of configurations you can put them in, and pyramids and mounds are pretty obvious one of them. There's people who I've talked to who are archaeologists in the Mississippian archaeologists who don't like it because they think it seems to be saying that their cultures are sort of derivative and weren't creative. And then there's other people who sort of poo-poo that and say, of course, ideas travel back and forth. And I think the answer is that we certainly know there was some communication. That's how corn, maize, got from Mexico to the Mississippi. But the extent of that communication and its impact is very much a live issue.
Well, I think it's becoming a lot more recognized because we're just getting a ton of calls, and let me see if I can take a few here. Rachel is calling from Hampton Bays, New York. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Jackie. Thank you for hosting this very important program. I just think it is the hubris and ethnocentrism of our culture that is continually astonished at the heights to which indigenous cultures and the extent to which indigenous cultures reached on our continent. I have a particular question for Tim, which is, I know there's a lot of controversy about the earliest habitation dates of in North America, and I'm wondering whether the extent, the magnitude of the urban Cahokian complex has in any way influenced people's understandings or the willingness to consider some of the very interesting yet controversial habitation sites way, way earlier than people had heretofore recognized that exist on the eastern seaboard.
Okay, thank you.
I think the caller is referring to the debates around Paleo-Indian and it is an overland route and versus a coastal route in which people came into the continent, and there's multiple dates and different sites, including some in the southeast that seem to be earlier than some of the agreed upon date, which was around 9 or 10,000 BC or so. And Cahokia doesn't really have, I mean, the work at Cahokia and the new things that we're thinking about, it hasn't really impacted that so much. But it definitely has made people go back and look at the earlier mound centers in like I say, Louisiana and across the Deep South. And it's made people think, well, maybe these could be not just built in a haphazard manner by hunter-gatherers, and maybe there was some kind of stable populations. If you can get a Cahokia, then at about 1,000, 1,050. So that I think Cahokia there has turned people backward looking backward to some extent, not all the way back to the Paleo-Indian, perhaps.
Let's sneak in one more call. Arthur is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hello, Arthur.
Hi, Jackie. I could say a great deal about our cultural arrogance, but I just have some specific questions about the mounds. Were they actually pyramids or started pyramids? Did they grow vertically, like vertical cemeteries? Were they ever used to display authority, like Mayan temples? Were they all earthen, or did they have other components? And also, when were they first excavated by archaeologists and anthropologists?
Thanks, Arthur. You're making me think we should have dealt with that earlier. They were sort of like well, Tim, you answer.
Well, there's a lot of questions there. yes. I mean, it depends also if we're talking about just about Cahokia or the entire eastern woodlands. But Cahokia's pyramids and a lot of the Mississippian pyramids in the south are definitely pyramids, and with the pole and thatch buildings on top that were managed and rebuilt time and time and maybe on an annual basis in some places so that the mounds did grow. I guess you could say that. They're being continuously renewed and refurbished, and that produces a growth. Sometimes, I mean, they're clearly adding on stages and going for height. Other times, they're just going for this renewal process where you lay down new earth because maybe it's the sacred quality and it's pure.
Well, looking at them, I think of the flat-top ziggurat in which these really impressive, they would be very eco-friendly homes of great thatched roof with subterranean basements could be placed. But I guess people are going to have to visit Charles and Tim if they want to see for themselves or at least check it out. Tim, just very quickly, in about half a minute, you spoke of the rupture. Why did it vanish?
Well, that's another really good question, and that's one that archaeologists are working on now. In fact, I've got a grad student who really wants to answer that question, and I don't know the answer, except that there were the same kind of political pressures and factional infighting, it seems, at Cahokia, as you see anywhere, and that seems to have weakened it. And then there was some climatic change that maybe gave it the second kind of knockout punch. And that seems to be – that may be the case for many other places, although not everything was taken out by climate change. So it's still a mystery.
All right. Well, thank you very, very much, both of you. Charles Mann, author of 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus, and Tim Pocketat, his fascinating new book, Cahokia, Ancient America's Great City on the Mississippi. We want to thank you both for being with us on OnPoint, and you can continue the conversation and get our podcast on our website at onpointradio.org, or follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at OnPoint Radio. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is OnPoint.